Hi, this is Julie Christensen with APSE. We're excited to launch the APSE Employment First, Employment for All podcast as a new way to connect with you. This podcast is a way to provide updates, real-time advocacy alerts, and information related to all things Employment First. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. And thanks for listening.
Jonathan Kaufman joined us for a conversation about the future of work. He's an executive coach and a psychotherapist, writes articles on Forbes about the mindset of disability and the intersection of work, which has really interested me for a long time. So it was a really interesting conversation that we jump into.
Absolutely. His perspective was great. So thanks for joining us today. Till recently. So it's been fun being able to read his different articles and posts to get a better idea of what he is doing to support Employment First, which it sounds like he definitely is.
So we'll jump into that conversation. It's between myself, Kari Tejan at National APSE, and Jonathan and Erica. So I'm Jonathan. Meet Erica Bellis-Pacer with National APSE. She's our professional development director, and I'm Kari Tejan. I am the certification director. You and I have spoken before, and I read your articles on Forbes, and we kind of chat back and forth and repost things on the APSE Twitter.
But I appreciate it so much. I really do.
Well, Erica, you want to introduce yourself so we all know who we're talking to, and then Jonathan, I think if it works, we'll just jump right into conversation. Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds great. So I actually used to be a teacher, and then I ended up running an education company, working with students that have disabilities and trying to make sure they were getting enough support both during school and after school. And then I ended up working for vocational rehab under a contract, and I got to train teachers on options for students after high school disabilities, whether it was a 504 plan they might have or an IEP. So that was fun because I was a teacher. I understood where they were coming from, the thought that you just have to get out of, graduate, not really thinking past what the future might look like, unfortunately. And then that led me to overseeing supported employment trainings across New York State. So I'm definitely familiar with the state. Jonathan, I think do you live in New York City?
I do. I mean, I live in, actually, we just moved outside of the city. But yes, I'm about in the New York metro area. We live on the island now, actually. And I'm a huge fan of it, but it works particularly in during COVID. It's served a real purpose. I haven't really gotten out of the house. So.
Oh, wow. So you moved during COVID. That's crazy.
I moved right before COVID. We literally moved and then, so then sort of COVID hit. And since I really don't, everything has changed because, my consulting life has certainly morphed. A large part of my practice always has been around executive coaching and psychotherapy is booming. That part of my practice is, and I can do that all virtually. Yep. So that certainly has changed the tenor of my work. And that's not a bad thing. It's just that everything has shifted. And that's fine. And I can do everything virtually at this point.
Yeah, I live in New York as well, but in the state of New York, not New York City, which most people, when I say New York, assume that I live in the city, but I live in Rochester, New York. So
yeah, you're upstate, yeah?
Upstate. Kind of Midwestern.
Well, that's how I look at it, New York.
Well, anything above Westchester is upstate.
Yeah. Right.
Yep.
I think also COVID has really sort of created this malaise and this feeling of fatigue. And yeah, I think we're at a point where you just want to just recently, and I feel lucky. I mean, I've had the second vaccine shot already.
Oh, good.
Because I am considered an essential worker, which I don't know exactly really if that's true, but psychotherapists and anyone sort of in mental health were considered essential. So I had the, and I, and but it still doesn't give me anything. I still have to be careful, and I'm not going anywhere. So it's lovely, and I'm glad it's done. And it gives me hope that there's light at the end of the tunnel. And I do have a father who is he specializes in infectious disease and in immunologist. So this is his area of expertise. So it's like calling the bat phone. You know, what is going on? Where are we? And he sort of keeps me up to date. So he really believes that, you know, by late summer, early fall, into the fall, we should be in a much better place. Not 100%, but definitely in a new part of our sort of this pandemic, and hopefully at the end.
Absolutely. Well, Jonathan, I want you to be able to introduce yourself and kind of your connection. Obviously, you mentioned your work in psychotherapy, but how we intersect around disability and employment.
Sure. I mean, I think that, you know, sort of my experience in all of this began personally. I think being born with a right hemiparesis, a form of cerebral palsy, certainly that experience changed the way I look at the world. And it's always sort of shaded the way I've looked at the world. It's certainly colored it in every prospect. And I realized sort of early on that this was something that I wanted to pursue both intellectually and academically. I thought I was going to be a full-time academic. I really did. And so I started to look at disability through an academic lens. And what I found was, what really interested me was the area of work. And particularly as I sort of started to go forward, you know, sort of I went to the University of Chicago in graduate school. And then where I was there, I got a graduate degree in public policy and social work, and looking at specifically disability issues. And I did a fellowship at what was the Committee on Human Development, again, focusing on that. Then I sort of leapt to Columbia University to do my doctoral work in applied anthropology, focusing on the anthropology of work and looking at the culture of work, but through a lens of disability. And what I learned from this, and because it was applied, was I didn't want to be a full-time academic. I wanted to say, okay, what's the application? How do we look at this? And taking all of what I've learned from an academic lens, I was able to really apply it to starting a consulting practice and looking at sort of different tentacles, if you will, or different buckets of areas. And so working with large corporations, government agencies, educational institutions, it really was about the question and the evolution of disability employment, how we look at employment, the nature of convergence of technology, culture change. All of this sort of played into an ongoing evolution. And for me, what I've sort of come to a conclusion about in terms of the future of work is that there really is an intersection of understanding of thinking about disability, not only in terms of a community and a pool of untapped workers as a marketplace unto itself from the position of work, but and I'm, you know, this is sort of what I write about in Forbes, and I'm expanding this to write a book about this, is really the nature of what the sort of modern disability narrative looks like, and that it goes beyond personhood and agency, and it's about a language of innovation, the lived experience unto itself. I mean, and I can sort of attest to this just not only personally, but there is a diversity of experience, because there, by nature, there is a diversity of experience amongst people with disabilities. But what's the language, and how is it valuable to companies, whether small businesses, mom and pop businesses, to sort of larger Fortune 500 companies, which changes the relationship in general. The relationship has always been initially, you know, starting as a sort of charitable issue, to then you get to sort of the disability rights movement, where, you know, we are people that need to be identified and we have value. Now you have to get to an even further. You have to take that, okay, what's the next step? Because I think we're sort of stuck in that. And I said, wait a minute. We have to look at it and say, what's the value proposition of persons with disabilities, but not only just persons with disabilities. It is, what is the experience and what is the tool that one can use as saying, wait a minute, we can look at this in terms of technology, we can look at this in terms of marketing and advertising, we can look at this in terms of a lens of innovation. And, you know, you can sort of go through a variety of industries and say, okay, why is this experience important? What do we learn? And I think that is going to be sort of the next phase of when we sort of look into a futurist approach of the 21st century and where do not only people with disabilities, but the disability experience play in dealing with the challenges in front of us. And what's fascinating is now that we're sort of in this COVID era, and I think we're sort of now, I don't know, again, I sort of can use a sports analogy, but are we at the 50-yard line or, you know, seventh inning stretch? I don't know. But wherever we are, COVID has been an accelerant in terms of the future of work and how work is changing. And we have now proof of concept. So the question now becomes, okay, if we have proof of concept and we've seen some real successes, that's been the silver lining through this maelstrom. We have seen some real successes. But how does that play out, in the coming 12, 18 months, particularly past the pandemic, and as companies are rethinking and retooling? Well, what does work look like in a sort of more decentralized approach? How do we look at this change management that's happening? Now it's important to think about, okay, well, how do persons with disabilities play a role in one, employment, but two, the general tenor of the actual process of work and everyday life? So what does that all mean? There are lots of questions that are out there, and the value to look and to really focus on the disability community as a valuable asset and can be used in terms of a learning tool, if you will, because what do we learn from this community? What do we learn from the lived experience that can be beneficial in our work life in terms of design, in terms of process, in terms of even looking beyond that to say developing products and services? I mean, you can sort of go down the list. So I think there is room, tremendous room for growth as we go forward.
I think we agree completely at APSI, from the perspective of our members, from the perspective of people working directly with people with disabilities. There have been so many opportunities, and like you said, proof of concept that remote working can happen. People with disabilities are often in essential worker jobs. I really value the perspective that you bring to Forbes as a writer, and I'm excited that you're going to write a book about these things, because thinking about the future of work, you're right, in the COVID pandemic has moved us 10 years forward faster in technology innovation. In terms of innovation, what do you think the future of work is going to look like?
Right. I think the culture in itself is going to have a reckoning of sorts, in the sense that they're going to have to reevaluate, well, what does work life look like in terms of a decentralized experience? I think after COVID, I think there will be a backlash in a sense of saying, okay, well, we want to be, you know, office space is one thing, but having a hybrid model probably makes more sense. And what does it mean to work from home and the ease at which one can work from home? Well, that benefits a lot of people with a variety of different disabilities. Yet we also have to see, okay, so we have to make sure that technology is accessible and excessive, you know, inclusive design of anything, whether it's technology or anything else, is beneficial to all. It's not, you know, contingent upon, okay, we are going to reach one particular sort of demographic, but rather we're saying, okay, this is about creating a better future, a more inclusive future. So it opens up tremendous opportunity, both from a market side as well as a human capital side. So you're looking at both of these things. So when you're looking at the sort of a futurist approach, you know, again, this all in many ways comes back to something I write about continuously, which is mindset. Because if you don't have the mindset, then everything else sort of falls by the wayside. So this is about rethinking and recalibrating our viewpoint. And one of the most important things that I've learned literally in real time is in my practice, both as an executive coach and as a psychotherapist, because most of the people I see are young professionals, you know, whether they're C-level executives on down to entrepreneurs, to just people that are working. It's the question of, okay, what do I need to know? What is it that I really need to know in terms of my what my future work life looks like, but in terms of stress, in terms of how I work? Because that's going to be the fundamental question. You know, will the sort of 5-day work week, 9-to-5, traditional work week continue? And my feeling is that that won't be the case anymore. I know that in Europe, they're testing out 4-day work weeks. I mean, you know, if you look at what's happening, I mean, just in Congress alone, senators and congressmen, they work essentially 3 days a week, you know, in their sort of in day-to-day stuff. I mean, they may work outside, but also the fact is we have smartphones so that our ability to work has changed. But there will be, and I go back to this idea of balance and pacing. These are essential words that will be continually needed in a moment in time where the walls between work and life are blurred, and almost there's a certain transparency. So pacing is going to have to be exceedingly important to think about, and what work means to people, because there is this need of purpose. I think now, because we've had such an enormous cataclysmic, you know, a sort of attack, if you will, not just on human beings, but on the economy itself, as we're bouncing back, how do we work smarter? These are sort of, all of these questions are out there. And again, that's dependent on the business itself, the culture of work, what it looks like. But persons with disabilities have to play an enormous role, not just purely in the human capital side, but I go back to this idea of saying, how is their lived experience valuable in terms of areas from workplace design to technology to thinking about just the idea of how one paces in their everyday lives?
I think that's really interesting. I used to give the example of, you know, in the United States, if you ask someone what they do, they typically tell you what their job is. You know, if you're at a dinner party or at some sort of event. Whereas if you're in Europe, in many countries, if you ask that same question, you may get a response of, you know, I hike, I read books, I do this. My brother lives in Portugal currently, and I found that when we went to visit that we did not talk about people's jobs. So I agree about, you know, the 4-day a week. So I hope you're correct. I hope that we can see some change here, because I think in many cases in the U.S., people are really used to working those 5 days, and I don't know that work-life balance is always that great. So I'm going to hope that you're right, Jonathan.
Well, we'll see.
Oh, goodness.
I think the technology side is also super important. You mentioned the access of it and the accessibility moving forward with these tools that allow us to work in ways that work for us, for our employers, for the economy. Yeah. And I also just think about what jobs are going to come back and which aren't, and how is that going to impact how we need to reinvent ourselves, our workforce, how do we engage people in meaningful ways that make sure they're not living in poverty, right? That's right. Also a big piece of this.
Right. And due to the fact that there will be an evolution, I think what people fear is, well, jobs coming back. What people often forget is because of an evolution, there will be new jobs. And there are new economies that are growing. And yes, they've been stagnant partly because of COVID. I mean, it's no fault. But I think as we go into the 20s, I mean, I think in many ways, this is going to be like the roaring 20s it was 100 years ago after the Spanish flu. I mean, we could actually look literally to historical documents and say, okay, let's look at the trend. You know, the Spanish flu happened in 1918 and 1919, and then the 20s happened, and then it was a booming economy for about a decade. I think very similarly that will happen. And I think it behooves anybody who's kind of looking at, okay, where are the trends? What do we have to look at? That, no, I don't want anybody to live in poverty if they don't have to by any stretch of the imagination, but what is it they need to know? And knowledge is power. And how do we access that knowledge? And how are we able to provide that knowledge specifically to people in the disability community? And what is it that they need to know, and what do they need to be armed with, so to speak, for the economy of the 21st century? What are things, you know, and it's not just sort of the traditional programming, but where is the economic boom going to happen? And this is sort of beginning to look at this from a futurist approach and asking the questions where, how, when. And it's beginning to sort of think about these things. I think it's very important to look at those particular questions. You know, again, there's an 8th century, or I guess 11th century, sorry, philosopher named Sadia Gaon, and he wrote a book. It was called The Book of Beliefs and Opinions. And the most important thing from that book was that he said the question is often more important than the answer. And sometimes in this case, I believe we have to begin by formulating the right questions. Once we begin to do that, then we can take those questions and say, what do we need to do to find better solutions, particularly for this community? And that's going to be, I think, the next stress test, if you will, going forward. What are the right questions? What do we need to be prepared for on the other side of COVID, on the other side of crisis? And how do we adapt to that quickly so that we can position ourselves from an area of strength, not weakness?
I'm chewing on some of the information that we're chatting about. That futurist perspective is something I think that we're really focusing in on at APSE. Some of our keynotes at our conferences have been thinking about the future of work. COVID obviously has changed a lot of the conversation, has sped it up, and just thinking about when is that economic boom going to happen, and what do people with disabilities need to know for the economy of the 21st century? Those are some of the things that stick out to me. And especially APSE members working to train individuals and help them get connected with businesses, that means they need to be able to speak that language too and be thinking about this. I don't know that we always have that conversation.
Right. And I think language is important. understanding what is the language of work and what is the language of innovation for the 21st century. What does it actually look like? And most importantly, and this is something I write about a lot and am working on, is what is the language of disability and its connection to innovation for the 21st century? And it doesn't just have to be work, but where is it when you look at work, where is it specifically? And how do you target that so that you're creating opportunity? You're creating opportunity more and more. And that, I think, is sort of vital. I always am amazed, sort of, and this is always something that I find interesting. You know, when I look at technology companies today, you can, I mean, just in terms of the people on the autism spectrum, the amount of, the number of people on the spectrum who have their fingerprints on across technology. I mean, everything we use, it's all there. So that persons with disabilities are very much part of the ecosystem, whether it's Silicon Valley or Silicon Alley or Silicon, you know, Prairie in Texas. You know, I think that it's really important to understand that design and technology have been part of the disability experience from day one. And so it behooves anybody to say, well, you know, shouldn't be a barrier, that they have been part of the creative process. And if you go to any of the sort of stalwart companies, whether it's Facebook or Microsoft or Twitter or wherever, the number of people, I would imagine, whether it's with disabilities, whether it be on the spectrum or otherwise, are significant. And, you know, and maybe it's not something that one talks about out loud. And I can guarantee this because I see this in my own practice. The number of founders and entrepreneurs who are dealing with significant mental health issues, which is an invisible disability, is significant. So the nature of disability within the sort of tech sphere exists already. It's just a matter of how do we redefine it to say this is something that's utilized, that can be seen as an asset, not something that's seen as a vulnerability.
When I was working with teachers and also able to work with students to some degree, we always said, you know, we're preparing students for careers or jobs or fields that may not even exist currently. So I grew up in the 80s, essentially. And I said to Kari that, you know, when I went to college, not many people even had computers. So, you know, I think it depends where you're coming from in terms of seeing that progress. But, you know, in a short period of time, there were a lot of advances in terms of technology available on all levels for all reasons. I do think that there probably are quite a few people in IT or, like you said, in businesses where they're using technology that probably have some form of autism. But, you know, also looking at how that impacts people with other developmental disabilities. I know you mentioned mental health. You're right, invisible disability. But yeah, how has that impacted, and what are we looking at for the future?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Again, these are all sort of open questions. But I think I go back to sort of COVID, it has revealed something. It's revealed these questions that we really need to tackle now. And we need to tackle them now, even more so, to prepare for what is to come. And there's a lot of what-if questions. And again, unfortunately, we don't have specific targeted answers because we have to play this out in real time. But what we can do is to say, okay, these are topics that need to be on the table, that we need to really be able to dig down into and see what is happening in real time.
I agree. I was actually going to ask your opinion on that. in terms of, do you see like a short window where we need to take, I don't want to say advantage, but really move on changing things when we can based on, you know, what's been happening with COVID?
Yeah, I think, look, that's the silver lining, you know, horrible as this virus has been, you know, we're passing 500,000 deaths now. I mean, this has been atrocious on every possible level. The silver lining is, okay, what happens next? You know, you're looking at, okay, we always think about best practices. Now we have to think about next practices. What are next practices? What do those look like? What can we glean from this? And that's very hard because a lot of us are sequestered in our homes, are socially isolated to some extent. I think it's less so now. I think people are, you know, masking is allowed for people to go out. But still, we're in this moment of apprehension. But what is important, and actually what's been, I can only speak for myself, what's been very nice for me is that I've been able to think and express and be able to really explore some of these ideas and actually see companies that are beginning to say, okay, we really have to reassess whether it's in the design space, workplace design space. I interviewed a CEO and a design team about, well, what will their company look like for the future post-COVID? How are they redesigning their entire space? To the fact of saying, okay, what do we have to think about in terms of the culture of work itself? How is that transformed? And what's the benefit for persons with disabilities on multiple levels and in multiple industries?
Yeah, absolutely. Just out of curiosity, I know you mentioned hybrid, which I liked that you brought that up. The bricks and mortar, yeah, I was curious what you thought about people or companies keeping, you know, what they have in terms of office space or, because, you know, it is a financial investment.
Yeah.
Schools are hybrid. We've been hearing from parents saying that hybrid actually has been beneficial to some kids with and without disabilities, which is, like you said, kind of a silver lining, different, but how do we think outside the box? So in interviewing companies, have you heard more of that hybrid approach or?
I think what I have continually heard again and again from multiple sources and multiple ways of my work has been, we really want to explore this sort of hybrid model. And while we will maintain a space, that space may be downsized in some capacity. But the ability to have that sort of social interaction and to see both verbal and nonverbal cues and being able just to sit with somebody, you know, at lunch and not through a screen. We are social creatures. Human beings are social animals. You know, I don't think that a screen and working from home is conducive for everybody. So we have to figure out what's the balance, and that balance will sort of play out. But I think a hybrid model will exist more and more. You know, and I always go back to, and this hybrid model has existed. If you go to a company like Google, for example, you know, sort of the 80-20 rule that they've had, where they created everything where everything was on campus. And it's not just them, but a lot of the tech companies. Now they've sort of have gone the complete 180, where, you know, people can work at home indefinitely. I think what will eventually happen, and this doesn't work for every business, because there are elements of businesses where there is human interaction that has to be, can be face-to-face, will be, yes, the company itself may be decentralized, but you may have these pockets, or satellites, if you will, where people can congregate and come together and work there if they want to all the time or not. You know, it will remain to be seen. This, again, is a TBD moment, you know, to be determined.
I know we talk, you know, when I talk to different employers and people in the workforce, do you think there needs to be more trust put into employees? I feel like sometimes that's, you know, what companies struggle with just in terms of accountability, in terms of people doing right. their work when they're at home.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's always an issue, but that's indicative of relationships and sort of corporate relationships. I'm a firm believer. I mean, Reid Hoffman, who was the founder of LinkedIn and a partner at Greylock Partners and has a podcast now called Master of Scale, he wrote a book called The Alliance, reframing the approach of employee relationships, that it shouldn't be a top-down approach, that in fact it should be an alliance, and that you are aligning with your employees in a social contract, if you will. And that social contract says, wait a minute, we are here to benefit one another. This isn't about, you know, this sort of top-down model. I know at LinkedIn, you know, in the interview with him, he always used to say, okay, I don't care what you want to do here. What do you want to do 5 years from now? That was one of the prime questions that he asked. So I think what is important is to say, why am I working here? When you're sort of looking at generations, like particularly millennials and Generation Z, the fact of the matter is they're working at a company, you know, 18 months, and then they're switching. So the idea of working at a company for the 30, 35 years is going and getting a gold watch at the end of the, you know, your tenure has gone the way of the dodo.
You're absolutely right. Yes, you're absolutely right.
So this idea is changing. So you have to look at it very differently. And COVID certainly has exposed that even more so and accelerated this idea. So maybe we have to, companies have to, and I work with a lot of companies who do this, and particularly also individual sort of C-level of saying, okay, how do I do this? How do I approach this notion of culture change within our organization so that there is a sense of building trust? There is this sense of how do we create an alliance, particularly when a growing part of our workforce is not in the office under one roof?
Yeah, I absolutely agree.
Some of the things that I've mm-hmm. been thinking about and some of the previous speakers we've had brought in to APSE include France West. So she talks about authentic inclusion, mm-hmm. and she really focused on some of the technology developments that you're mentioning and how it grows in the future and making sure that people with disabilities are involved in the next technology boom.
Yeah.
Particularly those that haven't been represented, like Erica mentioned, you know, people with intellectual or developmental disabilities, so that they don't experience any potential mm-hmm. discrimination for lack of being involved in the initial process or data gathering or user experience. How do people with disabilities use this time wisely to really get engaged with companies and with the technology development? That's kind of a broad question. I'm just thinking about it from job coaches even too, who are not familiar with some of those roles, some of those developing technologies. How do we start that conversation with the employment staff?
Yeah, I think it's sort of certainly interesting. And it's, you know, it's a sort of larger question. So let me sort of break it down a little bit. And I think one of the ways to really sort of look at this is to say, okay, what's the objective? You know, what are our objectives? I love the idea of Andy Grove, and Andy Grove is the co-founder of Intel. He talked about these ideas of OKRs, which are talking about objectives and key results. So he looks at this idea of an objective, and the key result is that idea is how to get there. So it is important for, particularly for job coaches, to say, okay, we're going to set up with our groups these OKRs, these objectives. If technology and understanding what is out there, what is sort of new and innovative that we need to look at. I mean, one of the areas that I think, you know, and that's really important to look at is gaming, for example. You know, and that involves coding. It involves players, for example. But though that industry itself is a multi-billion dollar industry that's continuing to grow. So it's, what do we need to know about that particular industry? And now I'm looking at that. But more importantly, I go back to the OKRs, is for job coaches to set up what's the model that we need to use and to think about in terms of what are our objectives for 2021, 2022, and 2023. I look at it as a three-year arc because we want to get out of COVID, you know, get past the real crisis. And then what does the next 2 years look like, or the next 18 to 24 months? And say, how do we evaluate the industry areas? And we look at different silos. I mean, and that's really important to understand what's going on, who's doing what. I think one of the best ways to do that is to sort of contact particularly the larger companies like Jenny LaFleur at Microsoft, for one. Google has an accessibility. Twitter has an accessibility. I mean, there are all of these accessibility accessibility officers that I think can be beneficial as an entree. It's not the end, but it's an entree into what is important from their perspective. What is it that they, you know, employers need to know for job coaches to say, okay, we need to now learn and I think ascertain new information. So where are we getting it from, particularly if we're thinking about the tech world? And I think, you know, chief accessibility officers certainly is one way through the door.
Yeah, it would be, and you probably have lots of conversations with those folks, I'm assuming. But yeah, I mean, do you think there's, do you think they collect feedback from people with disabilities?
Yeah, I think they have to. And I've written about ERG groups a lot, and not in the sense of a lot of other people, because I think it's an area where ERG groups is an area where you mine knowledge. Mm-hmm. And I think it's beneficial. And if you're looking at this from the perspective of an alliance, what is it that we need to know? We need to know this information, one, internally for our employee base, but we need to also know it externally. I mean, we sort of looked last year.
I'm just curious if you think they're good do you think it's consistent in terms of getting feedback?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I absolutely do. I think it's growing.
That's good. Sorry, I cut you off. I was just curious if it goes both ways. I mean,
no, it does go. As far as I've seen it, it goes both ways, and they, you know, it's very amenable because they want to know. They're curious,
right?
As a group, meaning, yeah.
I'm curious if, you know, I know we've had presentations, just like Kari said, with folks in those roles. I wonder if they get feedback from employment support professionals as well. I would think they would, but I don't really know.
I don't know either. I think it would be useful to find out.
Right. Yeah. I mean, obviously you want the information from the person that, you know, is choosing support, but seems like having everybody in the loop for success would make sense, but I don't know.
Yeah, it would be very useful.
I'm just curious, Jonathan, when you were growing up, did you grow up in New York City?
No, my dad was a physician and professor of medicine at Yale, so I grew up in New Haven, but my parents were from New York City, so we went back and forth. My father was from Brooklyn. My mother grew up in Manhattan. So my whole family lived in New York except for us, so we were back and forth.
I was just curious if you had supports when you were growing up, or if you...
I did. I mean, I had a significant amount of it. I mean, and the one thing is that I was part of a skiing group for kids with disabilities when I was in the second grade, which gave me a tremendous amount of confidence. And I went to Newington Children's Hospital in Connecticut for physical rehab regularly. But, you know, I'm fairly mobile after surgery. I became fairly mobile, but, you know, it's I learn how to navigate through this. You know, spasticity certainly hits. And I have an AFO, an orthotic that I wear every day, which really is very helpful. Mm-hmm. But it's such a part of who I am. It's been part of my experience and continues to be, because it continues to sort of shape my worldview.
Absolutely. Yeah. Did you connect with any supports when you were in college? I know we just had a conversation with another guest about, you know, there's different names, but the Office on Disability Support, there's lots of different names at different colleges, but did you use them at all?
Some. I mean, I did use them, but, you know, very rarely. I didn't need it. I didn't know. I'm trying to think because I went to a few schools. And I also looked, I mean, what was fascinating for me, you know, I went abroad to England and I was at Oxford University for almost 2 years, and I went to look for them because the English, I think the Europeans, the way they do it, is so much more entrenched in the culture of life. And that was really fascinating, and sort of the difference between that and the United States.
Yeah.
So that was really intriguing for me. But it wasn't something that I needed all the time. I felt that, you know, there were moments when I said, yeah, I could use it, but I sort of pushed on. But physically, there weren't any great needs for it. I was appreciative of it. And every now and then I popped in, but nothing that was utilized for my benefit or that I really needed.
I was just curious, yeah, because I think lots of people need support or maybe training or, you know, check-ins at different points in their careers. I know that we talk a lot about looking at careers, and I think you mentioned this, and I think it's universal, just the fact that I'm not in the first job I had. Millennials, I think, like you said, go from job to job, and that's just fine. It's just adapting and seeing what you need at that time. So
yeah,
very interesting. So when will your book be out?
Not for another year. I mean, I'm finishing up the final proposal. My agent said to me, because originally it was a little sort of, we felt that it was probably too narrow. And expanding it beyond being a business book into something where we really are focusing on, or I'm focusing on, the definition of what this new modern disability narrative looks like as a language of innovation, and what that means across multiple sectors, and how it plays out in popular culture, how it plays out in the future of work, how it plays out in the marketing and advertising, how it plays out in fashion, but then thinking about it in terms of truly a language of innovation and how that can be impactful in really dealing with the challenges of the 21st century for everyone, not just for persons with disabilities, but a language that transcends the disability experience. It goes beyond personhood and agency, but is a body of knowledge.
That sounds like it will be a powerful narrative. And I know APSI members, that sounds right up our alley. I want to read it. So in the meantime, I think we need to wrap up our conversation and hope we get to chat again soon. We've gone some interesting ways and I appreciate your perspective, as I've said. But for now, where can people find you? I want to give you the chance to self-promote a little.
Sure. I mean, you know, they can find me at J. Kaufman Consult on Twitter. And my website is www.jkaufmanconsulting.com. It's probably the best way to find me.